forcing people to work in an environment that's hostile to them doing their best is a terrible thing. If you approach things with what's going to be best for the people on this journey with us, then I think better outcomes will happen.
From Tuple, this is Distributed, where we show how world-class engineers and their teams tackle the challenges of remote work. I'm Jack Hanna, your host. Hey, everyone. In this conversation, we talk with Benji Weber, the co-founder and CTO of Jordy AI, where he's building AI agent risk management. Now, Benji recently started Jordy AI, having previously served as the VP of engineering at MindGuard, as well as senior director positions at Sneak and several other companies. He spent almost his entire career working through extreme programming practices, so he has a really unique point of view both on software engineering and on management. So if you're an engineering manager, this episode is going to be particularly tactical for you. We get into the paradox of giving control and what it actually means to create an environment that fosters ownership. We talk about how he leads teams through high performance. We talk about the challenge of balancing control with authority, as well as how he empowers teams using curiosity and gentle nudging. This episode was an absolute blast, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. So, Benji, we're psyched to have you on.
Thank you for having me, Jack. I'm glad to be here. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, Benji, I want to talk actually about how we were first introduced to each other, because I found it somewhat ironic. I was at the time doing a spike on how to effectively introduce pair programming and related practices to different teams. And a mutual connection of ours introduced us as, oh, Benji's a guy who knows a ton about this. And when I asked you about it, the first thing you said to me was basically that pushing these types of practices in them of themselves is antithetical to the origin of these practices. You've talked about this idea of the paradox of giving control. And so I'd love for you to define what is the paradox of giving control and what does that actually look like in practice?
Sure, yes. Yeah, remembering back to that conversation now. The paradox of giving control, if I give you control, but you don't take control, I haven't actually given you control. I've just abdicated responsibility, maybe. I can't force you to take control if I try to force you to take control of the act. If forcing you itself says that you don't have control because I'm having to coerce you in some way. So I want to give up authority. I want you to have that authority, but I can't use my authority to give up that authority in a way. So the very act of trying to give someone authority can disempower them. So I see it a bit paradoxical. And the most effective teams I've seen have a high degree of ownership. They have authority, they have accountability, they take ownership for the outcomes of what they do, they make decisions, they adapt if they don't achieve their goals. So they have control, no one's telling them how to work or micromanaging what they should do. But if you look at how they got there, I've yet to find a case where it's a manager like telling them they should go work in this way, because that tends to either be, I think, abdicating responsibility by putting the responsibility on them or undermining their ability to change and adapt their ways of working in the future.
Okay. Well, if your goal then is to have that outcome where your team has control, where they own their own practices and they're sort of consistently iterating on them to better and better ways of working, how do you get there as a manager, as a leader in that environment? How do you navigate this paradox of giving control in practice?
I see the job of management as creating the organization where people are taking control. A lot of it is starting with curiosity as to what's getting in the way of that naturally happening. Often at really small startups, you kind of get it naturally, like people who have high agency start startups. And then as organizations get big, they often tend back towards more bureaucratic ways of working, I think. So a lot of it is diagnosis, I think, like what's actually getting in the way of people acting with the agency that they actually naturally have. So that's often things like, are they clear on the goals? Like, can't ask them to take control in a vacuum. What do you ask them to take control of? Maybe you haven't been clear. You wouldn't ask someone who's not a pilot to take control of your airliner. They need to have the skills and capabilities to take ownership. And sometimes that means they can't take control of such a big thing and can only take control of a smaller thing. You need to help individuals grow those capabilities or help the team grow those through hiring, etc. There's often lots of things that disempower, like lack of authority, performance management concerns, perceived or imagined, things they're imagining that you want as a manager that you don't actually want. And ultimately, some people just aren't willing or don't want to work in that sort of environment. If someone's unwilling to do something, even if you tell them to do it and coerce them into doing it, you're probably just going to get going through the motions and malicious compliance, I think. So that kind of, like, how do we create the environment where individuals and teams can own outcomes and own how they work is the management job within the team. I guess we should talk about the other management jobs at some point.
Yeah. Okay, let me summarize some of the stuff that I heard you say, Benji, to make sure I understood it. In your mind, the true role of the manager is to create the environment in which folks can take control over both the outcomes and the ways of working to achieve the outcomes and have the skills and willingness to match that job. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, one of the jobs of management, I'd say, maybe not the only job of management, but yeah, for the teams that you're a steward of as a manager, I see that as, yeah, create the environment where the organizational, like, enabling constraints, tools, habits, etc., will support those people in doing their best work, and those people are getting better. Ultimately, you own the outcome. Like, you'll be judged as a manager on the impact that the organization you've been entrusted with is having for the wider organization. So it requires vulnerability in you as a manager as well to give up control and authority. I've seen teams that making much better decisions than I can make and achieving better outcomes than if I'd told them what to do. The opposite is also equally possible. If you can't create that magic, then you might get chaos.
Yeah. The stuff sounds nice in theory. I find it a lot easier to engage with when I can root it in practice. And so, do you have any specific stories or examples where you've done this to help articulate what it actually looks like to create this type of environment where folks can take control, where they understand the goals and that they have agency over them and the ways of working? I would love to hear some specific examples or a specific example of what this looks like in practice. A
couple of examples come to mind. There's kind of the organizational mission side of what we've been talking about, and then there's the kind of ways of working ownership that maybe we've not got into as much yet. On the former, I think a good example, escalating reliability challenge. We had SLOs in place. They were getting missed. They're getting missed by more every quarter. The kind of management hierarchy was not solving this problem. Lots of teams had their own, like, part in it, and the goal of reliability wasn't clear enough, I think, to all of the different teams, and all of them had quite a diluted incentive towards contributing to it because they're all juggling lots of different incentives of, okay, well, we promised this thing to this customer, and I said on my last performance review I was going to do this thing, and reliability is just kind of one of the many goals that they had, and it's kind of classic tragedy of the commons, diluted responsibility. Fixing the environment thing here was partly fixing the team structure. Like, we needed a team that owned this goal specifically and knew that they owned this goal specifically, not all of the other goals, and had the right skill sets in to solve the quite difficult technical challenges of fixing the things that were causing the bad reliability. In this case, it was about, like, finding the right people to go form this team, them to have buy-in that they were the right people to go take this mission on, own it, and go off and do it. Did not actually even put a manager in this team initially. It was a bit of a Avengers situation of, like, pull together the right people, get those people clear on the goal, ask them to take control of it. Them taking control of it in this case actually required them to be willing to break through perceived organizational restrictions as well. If, like, they'd need to change things that other teams had emotional investment in. They'd be willing to be courageous and take risks to do things that might have short-term impacts, that might be visibly breaking things because they have to act in order to make things better in the long run.
Were they naturally inclined to do that, or is you, the person who helped facilitate this, have to nudge them towards doing that sort of thing? Because that sounds like a pretty uncomfortable thing to have to do or position even to put them in.
Yes, absolutely. Part of it in this case was knowing the diagnosis we've talked about. It was partly about bringing together, in this case, experienced high agency individuals who would be more comfortable than earlier in career folks, maybe put in that environment. Also an element of people knowing that you've got their back as well. You're asking them to do this, but if there's knock on, then they've got some air cover. It was a difficult mission and had a lot more success than lots of managers trying to get lots more people to work on that mission over a much longer time period. So that's kind of a organizational mission.
Yeah, well, let's dig into the ways of working side of things. Sounded like you might have had kind of an existing way that you'd start talking about this topic, but I'll cede the floor to you and then maybe I'll ask a guiding question from there.
I think a good example is the team that I'm working with now at MindGuard. MindGuard spun out of academia. Founding team didn't have much exposure to industry ways of working, so also didn't have exposure to sort of the ways of working that I see at big tech that I maybe see as problematic either. So there's a lot of openness to try new ways of working, a lot self-discovered as well, just through the inviting folks to try things, retrospectives, and helping people reflect on the things that were working that they liked, that they want to turn up, coaching and a lot of the other gentle nudge techniques.
What are some examples of what this looks like? You join the team, how many folks are there, and how do you start nudging them or putting them in a scenario where they can take control of the way that they work?
Some of it is the stuff you mandate, right? I talked about retrospectives, but we're going to have at least one retrospective and then see what comes out of it, right? Small team, appropriate for me to facilitate that and have some influence over topics that come up, etc. And like through that, people were self-identifying lots of things. We actually drove the adoption of pairing, of coding standards, of continuous integration, etc., mostly kind of through that retrospective reflection process. It's not the only influence into it. I can share my experiences, it's hard to shut me up about things like pair programming. Obviously, I have structural authority in teams, so I'm always trying to ensure that my language doesn't imply that I'm mandating things, but I can talk about my experiences and places where I've seen pairing really help with, oh, this problem you're having. This is a time when pairing has helped with it. For example, one of the starting point, a lot of teams are in this situation, like there's one person who knows how X works, another person who knows how Y works, and when something happens with Y, then the person who knows with Y how Y works has to do it, but they're not available at the moment, etc. And a great example of how very quickly pairing can change that. Again, small team, I had the luxury of actually inviting people to pair with me, see what it's like. Again, power dynamic to be aware of as a manager trying that. It can work in small teams, I think. And then one-to-one feedback, things that aren't great happen. One-to-ones are a good venue to discuss those safely and also coach people into uncovering the better ways of working themselves as well, like continuous integration, the real continuous integration, not what everyone means by it now, of integrating your changes with everyone else's multiple times a day. I prefer to take it further on shipping multiple times a day as well. That is very self-discoverable from, oh, we worked on a change in a branch for a week and these are all the things that have been problematic because of that. So coaching can help people uncover those for themselves. Coaching, to me, is asking questions and helping people through the process of thinking things through and uncovering what they want to do about it as opposed to telling them.
One thing that stood out to me is that it didn't seem like you started from a place of thinking there are five practices, let's say, that I want to make sure the team ultimately gets to, and let me contrive this master plan to sort of ultimately lead people down this road. But instead, you mandated the first run of some basic things like retro. Hey, we're going to reflect on how things are going and what we could maybe do better. And then from the actual things that arise, in the example that you gave, knowledge silos, resulting in work maybe slowing down or not happening until somebody's back from vacation or being sick, what have you. People working on individual branches and trying to integrate them weeks later and running into all sorts of issues in that process, being the impetus for then considering, well, what would better look like? And guiding that via questions rather than making specific suggestions is a totally different approach than starting from, I want to make sure the team uses real CI and pair programs all of the time. And so I am going to mandate that we try these practices from day one, or sort of consistently try and persuade folks to apply these practices without specific consideration for what's going on today, this week, this month on the team that may be an opportunity for improvement. And so that was one thing that just stood out to me as you talked about this, that your approach is highly responsive to the context.
Yeah, I think someone, it may have been C.S. Lewis, to find humility is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. So like thinking of others, right? And it's right at the heart of the Agile Manifesto as well, uncovering better ways of working by doing it, right? Like that's, if you're kind of imposing your preconceived things that are the best for people on them, then to me that's not like trying to help them discover what the best ways of working for them are.
So how many different teams have you applied this approach to, where you were helping them uncover the best way of working for them in their context?
Depends how you define team for counting, because working in management, you've got the organization is constantly changing as well. We're talking 3-4 different companies, both in like direct manager of team, like now it's a small team, small company.
Sure.
But also in thinking about first team as well in bigger organizations, like when I've been leading organizational units as opposed to single teams, then I'm thinking about this mindset for how I manage my managers or managers of managers as well.
I asked that question because I'm curious if there's a consistent set of practices that folks have ultimately arrived at in almost every instance, independent of context.
No, not at all. I guess this inconsistency is something, there's a bit of a trade-off there as well for this style of working. You're accepting that not everyone's going to be working in the same way in your organization. There are trade-offs to inconsistencies of ways of working. And there are limits even for me of how much inconsistency to tolerate. Because otherwise you get a paradox of tolerance as well, where you allow things to undermine the organization that's being created. At Sneak, the bigger teams and organizations that I was leading there, like every team had a noticeably different way of working within the organization. Similarities as well, commonalities as well, for sure. And I'd like to think we leveled up the baseline over time too. And yeah, some of the teams that I've worked with have been very hostile to XP practices as well. I still believe that forcing those on them would not have helped them be a better team. It would have helped them be a different team.
It reminds me of something I've seen that you write, which is this idea that an individual developer who prefers working alone and having their space to work alone all of the time may in fact be more effective having their space working alone all the time, and the team may be less effective as a result of that. Mm-hmm. It kind of has a similar, just one layer up, which is to say, if each individual team is completely operating in totally different ways, it may be at that individual team's highest level of performance, and the company collectively performs worse because of the huge disparity in the set of practices that these teams are applying. Do you feel like that holds?
I do, and I guess an important bit of a nuance here for larger organizations is that it's not just a flat bag of teams, right? You've got teams that are composed of teams, and those higher level teams have the same kind of choices of how they work. So there may be things that you need to agree about your ways of working, like enabling constraints and restrictions of like the whole organization, but then also at kind of subunits of that. And then individual teams and individuals have autonomy like within what's best for their team. So you've got your end teams, then you've got teams of teams that will then have higher level goals, and there'll be things that individual teams could choose to do that would could undermine their high-level goals.
I want to shift gears a little bit, Benji, because we've talked about a handful of different ways that as a manager you can give control or approach the paradox of giving control of both the goals on the one hand, but also the ways of working on another. And we've talked about this mostly in the context of engineering practices, things like doing retro, doing stand-up, doing CI, doing pair programming, any of the other XP practices. And I think a different lens to look at this is sort of this balance between co-located versus distributed, async versus sync. And you have this great chart, which I mentioned earlier, which I think could be an interesting centerpiece in one of your articles. It's the tragedy of the return to hostile offices, which I thought was kind of a nice little piece. And you break down these different ways of working on two axes, async to sync, co-located to distributed, and have mapped this a little bit. And so maybe if you wouldn't mind explaining what this concept is, what these axes mean, and why you find most folks actually end up in this top left-hand side.
Drew this out because I hear people talking about remote versus co-located all the time and having internet flame wars about it and talking about different things, as tends to happen with internet discussions. Yeah, people talking about being together, but the benefits of different ways of working together, and people talking about being remote and the benefits and pros and cons of different ways of working together. So probably lots more dimensions as well, but I think an important one is synchronous versus asynchronous ways of working. And I've got probably most skewed experience towards the synchronous ways of working, with like extreme programming practices like pairing and continuous integration. The async style has been popularized, massively globally distributed open source projects where that's a very effective style of working. I found a lot of teams in that top left quadrant there of co-located and async, which I kind of see as the worst of both worlds. Like, asynchronous working introduces a lot of delay into processes. You end up doing a pull request workflow and then waiting a day for someone to review something. You send an email and you do something else while they're waiting for a response. And co-located has lots of benefits of there's much higher communication bandwidth in person than remote, although remote has got a lot better in that regard as technology has improved. I think it'll be a long time before it's as good as in person, if ever. So you've got teams, I think people are used to open source ways of working that have been popularized, especially through tools like GitHub. And it's kind of similar to the things that create resistance to extreme programming as well, I think, as an individual working on their own and not being distracted often. But maybe they're mandated to be in the office, so you end up with that. You're not really getting the benefits of high communication bandwidth working really quickly, but you're also not really getting the benefits of async, where you can work with very large groups of people who are in different time zones, etc.
Yeah, so what can you do? I mean, I guess underlying this word choice of survival is that you're only surviving, which is to say you're getting the worst of all worlds, right? You're not taking advantage of everything that async has to offer by being distributed. You're not taking advantage of everything being co-located offers by being asynchronous. Mm-hmm. And so what can you do as a manager to start to nudge folks or stretch folks into some of these other quadrants where you can take advantage of the inherent goodness that each one of these axes has to offer?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes there are things that force a change, and you can take advantage of those as a manager as well. There's some impetus to trying something different. People talk about a lot is the COVID pandemic, right? So everyone was forced to be remote often without a good setup and have to adapt their ways. Interestingly, I saw a team that in theory in favor of pairing, but in practice I never saw them pairing before COVID happened. Suddenly they were pairing constantly because they turned out they'd been impeded by the office environment they were in. Like, it was noisy, poor equipment, and it was getting in the way. They weren't all in the one office, they were in two different offices. But go remote, everyone has their own quiet setup. They started pairing even without any nudges. But yeah, so when there's a natural, something needs to change, maybe something's gone wrong for the team, maybe there's a return to office mandate, there are things that you can galvanize change around. But yeah, in the more there's the status quo, you want to encourage people to find something better, get out of their local maximum. Take probably a generally similar approach to things we've talked about already, of like looking for, being curious as to why they're there and what's stopping them doing something else. We talk about the kind of classic XP, all in person together, own your surrounding space. There's often things getting in the way of that, like when in some office environments where it'd be horror if you started reshuffling desks and changing what was on the walls, etc., and affecting the aesthetic. So maybe as a manager with more, a bigger sphere of influence, maybe that's something you can make okay for the team to work together. There may be perceived pressure even from yourself, like, are we allowed to pair because they won't be doing half as many things? You have to start with curiosity as to what's getting in the way of it, I think. And then you're going remote. Similarly, like maybe you need an exemption from your return to office mandate. Often I found it's actually easier to politically go for it's a remote team than even to change an office environment for some organisations, bizarrely. So yeah, look for what's getting in the way. See what you can do as a manager. Your job ultimately is tending to the environment.
Yeah, well, as you said, maybe not the only job, but a core job of a manager is to create the environment in which folks have the ability to take control of the way that they work and ownership over the goal with the skills and willingness to go out and do it. And so if that environment is the physical one or lack of physical one, you got to think about that and take that into consideration. One of the things that we mentioned a few different times is the existence of significant return to office policies or mandates. How do you feel about the common RTO push that so many companies are employing?
Mixed feelings. I'm probably most concerned about the kind of bandwagon aspect of it. And we're doing things because other big tech neighbors are doing it, as opposed to what's best for our team's mindset. Lots of that goes around, I think, and how people apply everything from, like, we saw the whole market consequences of layoffs, but also a lot of, like, other people are doing it, so we're going to do layoffs in this way as well, I think. Like, right now, there's almost a return to bigotry. Organizations rushing to distance themselves from DEI initiatives, and those problematic implementations of those, but it saddens me that's being used as a excuse to kind of bring back bias, and ultimately we'll have worse teams. I think if we go back to lazily hiring people we went to university with, bandwagons are bad, but return to office, I have like nothing in principle against offices, and I've worked with great teams that are co-located in office, and there's lots of benefits to office-based work. Yeah, again, it's the mindset. Like, if you being office located is the constraint that you decide that you're going to create for the organization, and we're going to create the best team for that, I'm fine with that. There are trade-offs. Like, for home, some people don't have a luxury of a good working from home environment, and I'm not a great fan of a lot of the co-working options. Office, it's hard to be inclusive to people with like caring obligations. Sometimes there's lots of reasons why office can be exclusive, but I think generally it's a situation where compromise can be worse. Part of tending to a organization that's best for some group of people does require being willing to not be the best organization for some other group of people. Often it is discrimination in a way, but you, like, every organization is going to either discriminate against some people or due to their circumstances, or be mediocre for everyone, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think the through line that I'm hearing from this and other things that you said is that whatever constraints that you pick, you should optimize for taking advantage of that circumstance, which is to say that if you're in person, take advantage of the chance for that super high bandwidth communication. Don't just come in person and do all of your work asynchronous. If you're going to be remote, approach remote in a way that allows you to take advantage of the fact that folks are distributed. So don't limit your hiring pool to people who are maybe only in the immediate geographic proximity, et cetera, et cetera. And so I guess leaning into the strengths of each approach, acknowledging that there are trade-offs, seems to be something that I'm hearing you articulate through all of this.
Yep, that's a good summary. You brought up my tragedy of return to hostile offices, but it's the hostile part that's the tragedy. So forcing people to work in an environment that's hostile to them doing their best is a terrible thing. If you approach things with the what's going to be best for the people on this journey with us, then I think better outcomes will happen.
Yeah, it does sort of pose the question of whether or not a return to office mandate inherently will work better for a smaller company than a bigger company, because there's just less of a chance that there are more people who will be hostile to that new working setup, or I should say where the new working setup will be hostile to that person. With a 40,000 person company, it's almost certainly the case that a whole bunch of the people that you're forcing to return to office will be in a worse off situation and perform worse as a consequence of it. Whereas if you are a 14 person company, you can probably fairly easily make the assessment as to whether or not being in person is going to be collectively better for you or not, and have that assessment's output be accurate to the reality of the situation. It seems sort of obvious once you say it, but I wonder if that would hold true.
I think there's nuance that obviously I bias towards the delegate these sorts of decisions and allow for teams that are adaptable to their context. Big organizations struggle to not be bureaucratic as well, often struggle to get the benefits of teams that are adaptive to their environment. That just tends to lead, I think, to management using sticks like force of return to office is going to change things in some ways that are good, some ways that are bad, but it'll be easier for us to work with whatever emerges from that. But I struggle with the fact that I see as organizations get bigger, they tend towards the bureaucratic. I like to think that it's not inevitable. And as a society, we manage lots of different organizations that collaborate via markets, etc. There are patterns that work at greater scale, I think. But companies often end up being bureaucratic as they get very large.
Yeah, it does feel like an almost inevitability of growth.
I like to believe that it's not, but don't have the evidence until I've been able to show it, I think.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, with that, because we're out of time here, I just want to thank you so much, Benji, for being generous with your time and perspective. It's always nice catching up and chatting. If folks want to learn more about you and your work, of course, we'll link to your website where you have a bunch of your writing that I referenced here today. Is there anywhere else that you direct folks to go?
No, I think, yeah, have a look there. And my contact details are there. I always like to hear from folks that want to chat about these sorts of topics.
Very nice. Well, good deal. Benji, thank you so much for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Chuck. You too.
Thanks for joining us on Distributed. If you want to learn more about what we covered in this episode, or if you want to share your own thoughts, follow @Tuple on X or visit distributed.fm.